Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Which means we'll be bringing you interviews about big ideas and books every day this week. You can also find lots of reading recommendations on the Thread page at nprnews.org/thread. This hour, a conversation about friendship, secrets, decisions, and moral authority. There's a friendship at the heart of Britt Bennett's debut novel that felt so familiar to me. Two young women with different values and different dreams and ambitions, different ideas of how to be in the world. And yet the intimacy of their bond is deeply nurturing for both of them. Nadia and Aubrey love one another, but they hold devastating secrets from each other, too. Britt Bennett's new novel is titled The Mothers, and she joins us from New York City. And Britt, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, I think you understood that moment that can happen in, I guess it's our teenage years, when this, when a deep friendship kind of snaps into place against the odds, you know, and it immediately influences who we are for years afterward. I mean, for everything else, I think that's happening in your novel, this for me was one of the things that drove the story. And you know, I'm interested in how you thought about it as you conceived the novel.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that friendship is the emotional center of the novel. I am really interested in general in friendships between and among women and the ways in which these friendships can be these sources of comfort and love and support, but also can be sources of betrayal. I think friendship, particularly when you're young, is so passionate and intense. And I wanted to look at how this friendship would evolve as these girls turn into women.
You know, what I was thinking is if these two girls met each other for the first time in their 40s, I don't think they would have been friends. I mean, that's the, do you?
No, I think you're right. I think that it really is a friendship born out of this mutual loss of their mothers, but it's a friendship that happens when they're young and could probably only begin when they're young.
Yeah. You know, this is something that I talked to Jacqueline Woodson about with her novel, Another Brooklyn. I wonder if you've had time to read it.
Yeah, I love that book.
Okay. So you know that she's also examining, and this is a friendship among a group of people, and obviously the story is quite different from yours. But we had this really insightful conversation about what it means to feel those bonds of friendship at that age. And I thought you might be interested to hear a little bit of what she said.
It's funny because I remember the same thing. I remember always wanting to sleep over my best friend Maria Ocasio's house, and my mother not getting it and saying, you know, you have a perfectly good bed here and a good house here and a good meal here. But there was something, I never could get enough of the time I spent with my close friends. And it's funny because I'm seeing it in my 14-year-old daughter now and really trying to remember my own self at that age before I say no to her, you know, and remembering how important it was to have those moments with your close friends.
So, Britt, you're in your mid-20s, so you're not that far away from this time in your life. I mean, are you drawing in some ways from your own friendships and the ones that you've seen among your, you know, your peers?
Yeah, I mean, I think back to when I was, you know, in middle school or whatever. I remember I would come home from school and call my friends on the phone. And my mother was always like, didn't you just see them at school? Why are you calling them? But it really was that type of insatiable desire to constantly be in contact with my friends. And, you know, like you said, I'm 26 now. My friendships have changed. There's not that same intensity that I even remember from 10 years ago. So I did draw from that level of passion and that level of intensity that I've noticed in my friendships when I was younger.
Do you miss that? Do you miss that intensity in a way? Or is that just, you know, it's about place and time and that's how it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think my friendships have had to become a bit more sophisticated now that I'm older. I don't live near a lot of my closest friends, so it requires, you know, logistical travel to see them and great effort and often money. So it's different than just being able to, you know, walk to your friend's house or see them at school the next day. So there's a new level of, I think, emotional depth to my friendships now, but also I do kind of still miss that level of excitement that used to be involved with all of my friendships.
Okay, so that's interesting because you grew up in California. Do you live in New York City now? Is that right?
No, I live in L.A.
Okay.
I live in L.A.
So you live in, but you grew up in California. So why is it that you don't see your friends?
Well, I grew up in San Diego. I live now in L.A., but a lot of my friends have since dispersed.
I see. They've left California. Okay.
Yeah. Some of my friends still live in San Diego. So when I visit my family or visit my parents, I'll see them. But, you know, then I've made friends in, you know, college and grad school. I went to grad school in the Midwest. So my friends live really all over. So, yeah, it's different than when you're a kid and a lot of your friendships are just based on proximity. You know, it's like, oh, this person sits next to me in the class or, you know, they live down the street and that's your friendship. But then when you get to this point where it's like, well, one of my best friends lives in San Francisco, the other one lives in New York. It requires a little bit more effort on your part to see people.
So I like what you're saying about that, because you also mentioned this emotional depth that you approach these new friendships with. In some ways, I think you're right. We now, when you get into your adult years, you choose people much more specifically than you did when you were, you know, in school in your teens. And yet even the intensity, it's odd how proximity still creates intensity. I think that's one of the intriguing things about friendships at that age.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think also part of it is, you know, I'm reaching an age where more of my friends are beginning to get married or beginning to create their own families. And I think these relationships, again, will continue to evolve as you have people who are having partners or having children. And that changes the dynamic as well. So that's something I was interested in with the book of, okay, well, what will these girls be like when they're older? If someone gets married and someone doesn't get married, that still changes that dynamic from when you're both just, you know, 17 and hanging out after school.
One of the things that you did was you created a shared experience for Nadia and Aubrey. And again, for our listeners, these are the two friends who are kind of friends unexpectedly. Neither of them has a mother in their life. And I thought that this, and for different reasons, and I thought this was intriguing, because I think a lot of contemporary literature is about the effect and the consequences of not having a father in your life. And you did something different with that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in, interested in mothering and motherlessness. You know, it's the huge theme of the book. And I was interested in how girls become women without mothers there to guide them through that transformation. Aubrey is a character who lives with her sister and her sister's girlfriend. So she has these female role models in her life, but Nadia really has nobody. So I was interested in how both of them would have these different experiences becoming women without their main sort of maternal figure there to guide them through that evolution.
Yeah, Nadia has, I mean, her mother has committed suicide. Her father remains in the home, but he's so enveloped in grief that he's very distant. I think he loves her, but he has no idea how to relate to her grief with his. Is that okay? Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that her father has been sort of the surprising breakthrough favorite character of a lot of people I've talked to, which is surprising
to
me.
Well, that's surprising. Really?
Yeah. A lot of people have told me how. And I think a lot of it is because he's in such a difficult situation. He's lost his wife in this really sudden and tragic way, and he suddenly found himself being a single father to this teenage girl who he doesn't understand in a lot of ways. There's a way in which I think as a reader you feel frustrated at him because he does sort of abandon his daughter in the wake of his grief.
Right.
But at the same time, you understand that he's going through a really difficult situation and you feel for him. So that has been one of the surprises to me of talking to just readers about this book, how many people just really kind of love and care for her father, even though he is sort of frustrating in some other ways.
Britt, I didn't feel like that at all. I wanted to shake him and say, the days and years are passing and you're missing it. Do
That's
you understand
really
why?
I do. And one of the funniest things about publishing this book was when my parents finally read the book. I went into the kitchen one day and I heard my parents arguing about the father. And my mom had the same feeling you had of just being utterly frustrated at him. And my dad was a lot more sort of empathetic towards him in his situation. So they both were kind of split on their opinion of him, which I think is probably representative of how readers will approach that character.
I mean, I feel like he let his life, when he had so many other things to contribute and wake up to. I feel like he let his life pretty much end or go. You know what I thought of this as? I thought of it as his world went from color and vivid, you know, and the sense of vividness to black and white on the day that his wife died. And he was a young man with a daughter, you know, to care for. And I just feel like it all ended for him.
I think that's true. And he kind of throws himself into the church. And that's something that Nadia struggles with. She feels sort of ambivalent towards the church, but her father finds that as his only real source of comfort in the wake of losing his wife. And that's kind of where the whole story is set. She's thrust into this this church community that and it becomes more involved with it than she ever anticipates.
Okay, I want to talk to you about the church in a minute, but I do want to talk to you about the choice of having Nadia's mother commit suicide and what that means for Nadia. I mean, she has to reconcile the idea that she's going to love someone who made a decision, mental illness, of course, as part of that, but who Nadia sees as having made a decision to abandon her. Why your choice about making that suicide?
Well, I think that I always knew that Nadia would not have a mother. I wasn't sure in the way that she would lose her mother as I began writing this book years ago. But I became interested in the idea of her mother committing suicide, the fact that there is some extent to which it's a choice, but also there is extent, like you're saying, mental illness obviously is a huge part of that. But I was interested in how this character would grow into a woman with this knowledge that, you know, from her perspective, her mom has chosen to leave her behind. I think that it's a type of loss. Suicide is a type of loss that's often associated with shame,
right?
Particularly for the people who are left behind. There's a way in which the church is very judgmental towards her mother, and she feels protective of her mother and wants to protect her mother from that judgment while also feeling this sense of abandonment, too. So to me, that became a really complex type of loss that I wanted to think about in this book that is largely about different types of loss.
You know, and what you're saying also means that the church's judgmental side of this, the fact that there's so much stigma still around mental illness, that Nadia really can't talk about this openly with anyone. Her father doesn't really want to talk about. It's not as if her mother had died of a terminal illness, the church and these mothers, you know, that give the title to the book, would have reacted in a very different way. But Nadia has no outlet to try to figure this out.
Exactly. You know, at the end of the day, she still lost her mother. But you're right. If her mother had died from cancer or had died in a, you know, car accident or something, there would have been immediate sympathy from the church. But the church views her mother as sort of selfish and even, you know, this idea of sort of succumbing to some type of, you know, evil or some type of demonic influence, you know, which is like a way in which I've heard suicide discussed in like religious communities before. So it's something that Nadia really does have to struggle with, the sort of loneliness of losing her mom in that tragic way.
There's a real ambivalence. You know this. I'm sure you've talked about this. There's a real ambivalence here that you're openly, I think, discussing about the embrace of the church and how powerful and nurturing that can be, but also the negative side of what it is to be drawn into a community that is going to make the kind of judgments that this church is making.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are ways in which churches, like any type of community, can be this huge source of comfort. You know, the idea that if you've suffered a loss, the church can really rally around you and, you know, send food and check on you and visit you in the hospital. And churches serve those types of functions in communities all the time. But on the same time, there is this downside to that. You know, it's a tiny church. It's the type of church where everybody knows everything about everyone. And that sort of claustrophobic nature of the church is something that Nadia kind of constantly is struggling and pushing against, trying to escape from this really claustrophobic feeling of the church and these mothers who are kind of all seeing and all knowing.
Do you think it would be any different in any other kind of social organization, you know, that was, is there something about the fact that, as you point out, this is a faith community where they feel better equipped, whether they are or not, to make judgments?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something particular to it being a church. You know, the idea that these are people, you know, churches are places where essentially strangers or people who do not necessarily have these, you know, deep intimate bonds to each other are sort of gathered together to talk about issues that are like huge sort of, you know, emotional, very emotionally weighted issues, huge, you know, psychologically weighted issues, the ideas of like life and death and morality and how to be a good person and how to move through the world. But you've got a whole bunch of people just from everywhere kind of gathered to talk about these gigantic issues that, you know, are affecting your body and also affecting your spirit and your mind. So I think that, you know, the church is a very particular place compared to some type of other social organization. And that's part of what makes it so interesting as a setting for a novel.
This is also, I mean, this is a Black church. And I'm going to say that I don't know that, I mean, I grew up in a Lutheran church. I don't know that it's all that different depending on what kind of a church you're in. I think human nature tends to take over, right? Denomination. And maybe we all behave the way that's pretty familiar to us, no matter what kind of faith we're practicing. I'd be interested in what you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent time in a lot of different types of churches. My mom is actually Catholic, so I went to Mass a lot as a child. My dad is Protestant, and his church was mostly Black. The church my mom went to was more racially diverse, but not a lot of Black people. So I spent time kind of bouncing among denominations and among different cultural expressions of Christianity.
Wow.
So that is something that's kind of interesting to me in general, of how people who essentially believe the same thing in a big picture sense express it so differently. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was particularly interested in this as a small church because that really does force people to be around each other. The church my dad went to was pretty large, which wasn't interesting to me narratively. Because there was this escape. There wasn't that sense of being trapped in the way that some of these small churches, you know, are. But I think also just interested in, you know, historically the role of the Black church within the Black community has been a pretty major institution as far as political action or even just this idea of solace from a really hostile world and a hostile environment. So I think I was also interested in the Black church in that way, in the way it can be this source of comfort, you know, both spiritually and politically, but also can be the source of oppression in both of those ways as well.
Britt, this is kind of intriguing, though, about how your parents worked out, you know, their desire to practice different forms of faith. So on Sunday morning, your mother would go to her Catholic church and your dad would go to his Protestant church. And you would try to figure out who you were going to go with on Sunday mornings?
Well, I mean, the thing is, my parents are still, like, my parents just celebrated their 30th wedding anniversary. So I lived with both of my parents. It wasn't even like a two-family sort of situation.
Right.
But yeah, my mother is from Louisiana. She grew up Catholic. And we would go to Mass with her. And my dad would kind of just go to his church by himself.
Wow.
And then there came, like, a switch. When I was in middle school, I guess I should ask them when this was discussed, but at some point we all decided to go to my dad's church. So I stopped going to Catholic church. I did not get confirmed in the Catholic church. I did some of the other sacraments up until that point, but then we switched and started going to my dad's church, and that's where my parents go now. So, you know, it was always, we would go to my dad's church for like Christmas and like different holidays. That was like the only context in which I would normally go to his. But most of the time I would, you know, I went to CCD and I, you know, I grew up going to this Catholic church. So it really was kind of a thing I've realized is more odd as I've gone about and talked to people about this book. But that really was a feature of my upbringing, was like these different, very different church traditions and different demographics at both churches and different expressions of a faith.
So given the fact that you overheard your parents arguing about the father in this book, what do you think they think of the church representation? Because as I noted, for as embracing as this church is, this small upper room church that you've created in the book, boy, these people, they're mean. And they, you know, they are at a time when one of their members, I'd say, needs their lack of judgment most. Boy, they're mean. So what do your parents think of that?
It's a good question. You know, I think my parents are people of faith. They are still involved in their church. But also my parents never really had this very rosy view of church.
Really?
Like my parents were, yeah, I think they were always very realistic about it. You know, I remember my mom telling me about, like, you know, you have to watch out for church people, because when people know that you're capable of doing something, they might start taking advantage of you in that way of, you know, so she was like, well, don't, you know, this idea of often, you know, like the way, in the way that Nadia's father, he has this truck and people ask him to do everything with this truck, which is often what happens when you own a truck. But this idea of the church just sort of being like, well, he has a truck. We don't really want him there, but we need his truck. So let's let's use that, which, you know, it's like a human thing. But I think that I always grew up kind of aware of some of the limitations of these spaces. And, you know, my parents are naturally sort of very realistic about these types of things. But I haven't actually talked to them about their opinion of the representation of the church. I think they would probably, I think, understand sort of that type of complexity where it can be, I think about when my grandpa died and the way that his church all rallied around us and, mm-hmm. you know, those types of things. But at the same time, recognizing that, you know, again, these are all just human people gathered,
right.
doing what human people do,
yeah,
for better or worse.
Exactly right. I mean, for as much as we think we are our best selves, in our churches, and we probably show up like that on Sunday morning, we're still who we are, right?
Exactly.
The rest of the week.
Exactly.
Britt Bennett is with us if you've just tuned in, and we're having a conversation about her debut novel. It's gotten a lot of attention. Loved it. Steph Curtis loved it. It's called The Mothers, and you can read more about it on The Thread. And this is Thread Week, so I'm saying big books and big ideas and lots of book recommendations. So if you've never checked out The Thread, this is the week to do it. Okay, so Britt, a little fangirling going on here from me, because I know that this is your first novel. I know it took you a long time to write it, but you're in your mid-20s and you have the surest hand as you bring in a lot of these really complex issues. I mean, we're going to talk about abortion here in a minute, but we've talked about the suicide of a mother, and we've talked about faith, and we've talked about friendship. And you just handle that with the assurance, I think, of somebody who's been doing this for a lot longer. You know, and I know you're going to say thank you, but I really want to know how this happens in somebody that is as new to this as you are.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I think a lot of it was just, you know, growing up reading authors who I think did those things well. You know, I like reading books that make you feel things, books that resist being sentimental but still include emotion. I don't like books that try to be too clever for their own good and sort of have this, like, detached, ironic thing of, like, you know, everyone wanting to have this, like, layer of irony so you don't risk being sentimental, but then on the downside nobody feels anything. So, you know, I think part of it was just sort of gesturing towards those people I grew up reading and enjoyed. And, you know, and like you said, a long time of working on this, a lot of workshops I went through and friends who read it and gave me feedback along the way. So, yeah, I've been fortunate that that this book has come out so soon, in a sense, but also in the other sense, I've worked on it for 7 or 8 years. So it feels both like it happened really quickly and like it happened pretty slowly at the same time.
You know, I appreciate what you said, that you're resisting sentimentality, but you're also, the minute you said that about resisting kind of the distance of irony, I thought, and I love Jonathan Franzen's work, but that's how I think of what Jonathan Franzen does so well, that kind of distance, that irony, that's something that hasn't been very influential, not just him, but as kind of a method of writing, has not been influential for you.
No, I mean, I think it's safe. I think that there's a safety to writing in this detached way that I don't like. You know, I like authors who risk, and I like authors who put it all on the page. And even if sometimes it veers into the sentimentality, I would rather read a book that does that but actually makes me feel something than a book that just leaves me cold. And often that's how I feel about novels, where I'm just like, oh, the sentences are good, but I didn't feel anything reading this, you know? So I think writing, it's such an exercise of vulnerability, And it is something that's scary to try to evoke emotion. But it's also something that I think is the most worthwhile part of writing a novel.
Yeah, but see, you did this, though, in the context of writing about the decision that Nadia, one of the two main characters, makes to have an abortion. And if ever there was a place, I think, to get to a difficult decision that I know you had to make to not go overboard on the sentimentality, on the this will change her life forever, you know, that kind of so easy to go down that road. This is not that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that it was something that it took a lot of calibrating over time.
Yeah,
there were earlier drafts that were just too, like, no one felt anything. Mm-hmm. There were other ones that were just too maudlin. And it took a lot of sort of back and forth because I think essentially, you know, in fiction, when characters make choices, those choices have consequences or they have some type of emotional weight. But on the flip side, like you're saying, I didn't want this to be, you know, this is the choice that destroys her, or this sort of narrative that we often hear about abortion. I wanted it to be something that has an emotional weight that she continues to think and feel deeply about, but not something that ruins her life or that even necessarily defines her life.
Right.
So to me, it took a lot of work over time to make sure that this was something that would have these ripples in her life as she got older, but not something that is the defining thing about her. It's a choice that she makes that has consequences, but it's not, you know, this sort of choice that completely destroys her.
And the unusual thing about her that read authentically to me is that even in the moment of making the decision, she's young, she's frightened about, you know, what the procedure is going to be like, what her life's going to be. The fact that the boy that she's in love with is not going to be there for her. There's even still kind of a consciousness that, like you said, this doesn't have to define her. I mean, she's aware of that even in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I was aware, you know, I don't think I thought a lot about the politics of writing about abortion when I was working on this book, mm-hmm. because this was a decision I always knew this character would make. That wasn't really a political decision for me. That was just a craft decision and a story decision. But at the same time, I knew that I wanted it to be something that had consequences and something that she thinks about. So, you know, it's something that happens really early in the book. It's not like a hidden plot point or like a spoiler. It really is sort of the launching pad for the rest of the story.
Right.
But I knew I wanted to begin there because I didn't want this to be a book where, like, oh, she's waffling about what she's going to do about this pregnancy. I knew what she was going to do. So I just wanted to start there and see what was going to happen after.
I think it's kind of surprising, though, that you didn't think about the politics of, and I'm not saying that you had to get that into this story, but really you were kind of that removed of from the politics of this in this time that we're in?
I mean, I knew that it was a political decision to write about abortion, period,
yeah.
regardless of what decision the character makes. I knew that. And there were moments, like I said in earlier drafts, where, like, she encountered protesters or there were these other things that were more overtly political about that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, like, the politics were not interesting. Like, I think that political debate is so oversimplified and, you know, it creates this really neat dichotomy of you can only feel one of two ways about this incredibly complex emotional and moral choice. And I really resisted that. I think, you know, coming of age sort of during the Bush years and when the idea that, like, abortion was like one way of just defining your politics so simply, I always was just really skeptical of that and just from a craft's point of view, found it very boring. So I knew that I wanted to portray this issue as multifaceted as I could and to include characters in the book who feel so many different ways and so many complex ways about abortion, which I think is how people feel in real life, you know, in contrast to the way our political debate often just simplifies it.
You know, so now I'm curious about I know you wrote an essay for Jezebel in 2014. I went back to read it about what it is to be African-American and have, quote unquote, good white people join the cause and your ambivalence about that. And I wonder if some of what you were thinking about then, and we'll post a link to the essay since I'm referring to it, but I wonder if some of what you were feeling and thinking about has come back in the wake of Donald Trump's election and the protests that are going on and some of the things that we're hearing. Have you been thinking about that again?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually joked with a friend about, like, having a Donald Trump remix of that essay.
Really?
Because, yeah, I mean, and, you know, there's a way in which I have been, people have been posting that essay a lot after the election and tagging me in it. And I also have been, again, continually thinking about sort of the roles of you know, good white people or, you know, white progressives in this election. You know, I'm thinking, you know, just specifically about the sort of safety pin movement that mm-hmm. people have been doing. This idea of wearing a safety pin on your clothes is a way of demonstrating that you're an ally. You know, and it's like, on one hand, it's like, well, I guess this is a well-intended gesture. But on the other hand, it's like, no, the way to demonstrate that, you know, you are in support of marginalized people is to be in support of marginalized people. It's not just to wear a safety pin on your clothes. So, you know, there's a way in which I do continue to feel ambivalent about, you know, there's been so much, I think, in my conversations with a lot of white progressives throughout this past week, there's been a lot of shock in a way that talking to my friends of color, nobody is really that surprised by the way the election
is that right?
turned out.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and even talking to an older generation of black people, talking to my mother, you know, she grew up in the Jim Crow South, and she's not, you know, she's disappointed, but she's not stunned in the way that a lot of my white liberal friends are just really shocked. This sort of disappointment of, you know, this, it feels like this newness of this disillusionment with your country that a lot of people of color have been feeling for generations, if not, you know, just years for those of us who are younger. So it's been interesting to occupy a lot of these spaces during this past week. And, you know, I don't know if I will write about that someday, but it has made me think back to that essay and in the ways in which this election has, like, revealed some new layers to it.
You know, I thought about you and the essay when I watched Saturday Night Live and Dave Chappelle and those funny skits about white progressives pointing back.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Pointing back at African-American voters and going, you know, where were you? What, you failed,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, Dave Chappelle had a joke during his opening monologue where he was saying, like, I haven't seen white people this upset since OJ. And
right.
It was like a funny joke, but it also made me think of sort of the analogs between these two events where, you know, OJ Simpson, there was a sense in which for a lot of white people, that was like a defining moment of realizing that the criminal justice system is unfair, where a lot of people of color are like, yeah, we knew that. And I think that this election is similar in the sense of a lot of white people, I think, are like, whoa, large swaths of this country are either actively supporting or complicit with white supremacy. And a lot of people of color are like, yeah, we've been saying this. So it's, you know, it's been an interesting moment in that sense. And, you know, I don't know what will come next, but I'm sure that, you know, a lot of writers and particularly writers of color are going to come up with some really interesting work.
Do you feel like, Britt, that you learned something about America that, you know, that you didn't know? Or is that a question that comes from someone like me and you'd say, no, we knew that. Just wasn't it as open, but we knew that.
Yeah, I think my sort of deepest anxieties about America were confirmed.
I see.
It wasn't so much learning something new as so much this is what I've always sort of felt and suspected, and that was confirmed in this moment. You know, I think to me the really stunning thing is, you know, you have a person who, you know, has first time in American history, we've elected a president who's never served in the government, never served in the military. A person who, you know, in most objective standards is not qualified to hold that office. But at the same time, people are clinging so much to this idea that, you know, that Toni Morrison talked about this in The New Yorker this morning, this idea of that, you know, white people are losing power, you know, they may become a minority, you know, this sort of fear of the other and the fear of losing power. And people are so terrified of that, that they're willing to hand over the keys to a person who is objectively speaking unqualified to run the country. To me, that thinking of the scope of it, that was something that hit me really hard the next morning. You know, I think to me it's different if there are, you know, oh, these two candidates have different policy ideas and maybe people chose this policy over the other. You know, but the fact that you have someone who really does not know what he's doing, and that seems pretty apparent already, and people were willing to take that chance and stake the future of the entire country, would rather do that than sort of give up any type of claim to racial superiority. To me, that's been the thing that hit really hard.
Britt Bennett's novel is called The Mothers. You can read about it on The Thread, and I will retweet the essay that we've been talking about here at the end of the interview. Britt, come back anytime. What a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great. Thank you.
NPRnews.org/thread.